With me today is Professor Raymond Jonas, a professor of history at the University of Washington, who is recently the author of The Battle of Adwa, African Victory in the Age of Empire, published by Harvard University Press.
Thanks for joining me today, and I'd like to start the interview by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself, an intellectual biography of sorts, how you came to write this book that we're considering.
This is, in fact, a book that I, in effect, fell into. It's a book that had a clear moment, a clear genesis. It came about in thanks to a visit I made when I was in Boston. I was at a conference there. It was the American Historical Association, and I was part of a search committee. And after a morning of interviews, we were finished for the day, and I decided I needed to get out and walked to the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. And in a way, it was a busman's holiday. I thought, well, I should go and look at the modern European art. And I did that. I was the dutiful scholar. But on my way out, I saw an exhibit of photography, and that's one of my avocations. It happened to be an exhibit of the work of a Bostonian, a photographer named Fred Holland Day, who was active in the turn of the last century. He was active in the 1880s, 90s, during the critical years in terms of photography, when photography is making this transition to a fine art or making a claim on being a fine art. And I walked into the exhibit, and there was this, I was immediately drawn to a portrait of an African-American. And I took a look at the image. It's an aesthetically pleasing image, which was rare for its time. And then I looked at the caption, and it said, "Menelik, victor over the Italians at Adwa, 1896. And I was riveted by the image for a couple of reasons, partly because it was an aesthetically pleasing image. And for that period, African-Americans existed in the realm of photography, but mostly as the objects of a kind of folkloric condescension. And there are plenty of examples of that. This was instead was a kind of an image of grandeur, and it was unusual in that regard, but also unusual because I knew the story of the Battle of Adwa. And what I had not understood until that time was how the story of Adwa, the story of African victory in the Age of Empire, would have played in Jim Crow America. That was the America that Fred Holland Day lived in. He was of European descent. And I understood, I mean, this was clearly a studio shot, and I understood immediately that he had, in effect, sought out an African-American model, brought him into a studio. The photo is laughable in some respects. It's a hodgepodge of Africanisms. He dresses his model with pigeon feathers and brass gadgets and medallions. This is an African monarch of the imagination, but quite clearly he was using the photograph as a meditation on this story, on the Adwa story. And I took that. This was all of a sudden I understood that there was a book to be written. It would not be Adwa as an African story or as a European story, but also as an American story. And so in that sense, a story that hovers, if you wanted to fix it in space, somewhere over the Atlantic, a truly transnational story. By the time I got back to my hotel, it was snowy January. My mind was racing, and I had already figured out a rudimentary chapter organization. I mean, it was a book that took shape in my mind very, very quickly.
Well, I like the book because, of course, Adwa is a battle that's familiar to anyone who's interested in military history or teaches it, but it's usually just a kind of almost like a token where, I mean, it stands in for the rare instance of an African victory. Of course, there are a couple of others,
right.
But also of the kind of the ineptitude of Italian colonialism. It's kind of a straw man as an event, I guess.
That's true. I mean, and I was aware of that. On the other hand, there were a couple of things that were quite clear to me. First of all, this is not a setback on the scale of, say, the Zulu triumph over the British is on Luana, where eventually the British do triumph. I mean, this was a decisive victory, and it preserved Ethiopian independence during the period of high empire. And for that reason, it deserves recognition, it seemed to me, because it preserves this exception. And the cultural impact, of course, of this exception is enormous, not only in Africa, but also in the African diaspora, where it's clear that, yes, Africans can be free, they can defend themselves, as they had done at AGWA. It matters, too, in the broader, in Europe and in the broader European diaspora, because up until the Battle of AGWA, there was what passed for common sense in the 1890s was that the fate of Africa would be like the fate of North America, a kind of manifest destiny of European settler population moving across the continent. And even African Americans were taken with this idea. If you read some of the prominent figures, they're rather gloomy about the prospects for an independent Africa in these years. And AGWA strikes as a kind of lightning, and it shatters this common sense vision of how the future of Africa is going to play out, how the history of Africa will play out in the 20th century. So at the level of symbols and level of cultural perceptions, it's enormously important. And as for the small power thing, I mean, I think it's interesting to, yes, it's true. I mean, Italy is turned back, although they did have successes in colonial ventures elsewhere. But the story of empire never was a small power, or rather exclusively a big power story. There are plenty of examples of powers of relatively modest means that managed to establish rather substantial imperial holdings. The Dutch, the Portuguese, notoriously Belgium. So the idea that one has to be a big player to succeed, is not necessarily valid. So it's my idea then was to look at AGWA both as a military story, but also as a story about challenging common sense at the period of high empire, that is in the late 19th century.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned the Dutch. I've had occasion recently to be reminded, as if I needed the reminder, that the persistence of the Dutch Empire right into the 20th century, and,
sure,
and into the period of decolonization, along with France and Britain, and
right,
that. So it's that's a worth the reminder, as I said. Well, but the book is also interesting because it's called The Battle of AGWA, but the story you tell is really of a campaign,
right?
And also you set it into the context of the political environment in East Africa and even into the sort of prehistory of the battle in terms of politics and the struggle for power within Ethiopia itself. Tell me a little bit about how Menelik comes to power then, this character that you saw in the photograph, or who was modeled in the photograph.
Sure. Menelik is a fascinating character. He's in some ways typical of the rivalries within Ethiopia for power. I mean, he is a monarch of a province in southern Ethiopia, a province called Shoa, and he uses his position of authority there in order to challenge the person who would be his predecessor as emperor of Ethiopia, Emperor Yohannes. And Menelik, oddly enough, I mean, for being the emblem of Ethiopian patriotism, actually worked systematically to undermine Emperor Yohannes, to whom he owed loyalty. Menelik was willing to work closely with the Italians. In fact, in a sense, Menelik was sponsored by the Italians in their attempts to undermine Yohannes in the 1880s. So he's at least initially a modest regional player who's trying to jockey his way into power by working with the Italians, who are giving him firearms, who are giving him systematic support in diplomatic terms. They're building him up as a rival. And of course, when ultimately Yohannes dies and Menelik claims the throne, they, in a sense, they understand that they've won. I mean, this is their guy. They see Menelik as their client in Ethiopia. What they hadn't reckoned on was that Menelik, having arrived at power, would turn on the Italians. This is part of what I talk about in the first third of the book, is how Menelik is really a quite savvy operator. I mean, he's willing to undermine Yohannes, but in the end, he's Ethiopia's best chance for independence, and he uses his position as emperor to pursue a national Ethiopian goal of driving the Italians out.
And he has a couple of other significant allies in this struggle. The first being his wife, who you spend a lot of time talking about.
Yeah, at the core, this is the story of the battle, but the book is divided into thirds. And in the first part, laying out the story and in particular developing the characters, I go into some length in talking about his wife, Empress Taitu, who is from the north, Menelik's from the south. And she's not only gives him a kind of geographical strength in a part of the country where he's likely to be treated with suspicion, but she's also quite effective politically herself. She brooks no challenges at court. She's perceptive in her own way about how power operates. In fact, she's a kind of Europhobe. Her reaction to the presence of Europeans, her suspicions about the intentions of Europeans, is so dark that it's said that she dislikes the odor of Europeans. She has a deep reaction against them. But the combination of Menelik, who, despite his sometimes harsh appearance, Menelik, who's this rather gentle soul, or comes across as a rather gentle soul, and Taitu, who is this rather fierce defender of Ethiopian interests at court, this combination is really powerful. In colloquial terms, it's the equivalent of the good cop, bad cop routine, where Taitu stakes out a maximalist position, and then that creates an opening for Menelik to come in and negotiate an agreement that works well for Ethiopia, but also is agreeable to Ethiopian partners. So it's a very important relationship. And if you look at the photographs of this couple late in life, and there are some photographs of Menelik and Taitu in a very private setting, and you can see a kind of comfort and a closeness between them that would be very difficult to fake. I mean, these are people who really like each other, not only as political partners, but as friends. And you can see that this relationship works for them on a lot of different levels. And of course, it's a critical relationship for the successful defense of Ethiopia.
And the second alliance that I noted with Menelik is a set of European ones, I guess, partly with the Italians, that he obviously reverses that, but also with individual Europeans. You mentioned this gentleman, Alfred Ilg, and a few other, somewhat surprisingly, the role of the Swiss in all of this.
Right.
Took me by surprise.
Yeah. One thing that's really clear, I mean, in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, and we talk about the hearts and minds strategy for third world countries defending themselves, something like that, right? Quite clearly, something like that is at work in the defense of Ethiopia. Alfred Ilg is a Swiss engineer who, for reasons that are apparently have to do with his personality, his desire for starting over again for something new, he makes his way to East Africa when he's 25 years old. He goes there. He's sent by a firm operating out of Aden, and he is sent to the court of Menelik. At first, he's simply an engineer. He does bridges and roads projects for Menelik. But over time, he proves his usefulness, not only to Menelik, but to Taitu. And he becomes a kind of factotum. He begins to do not only engineering projects, but he's involved in procuring items that are of interest to the court on his many trips to Europe. So he's deployed to Europe to do things like buy agricultural equipment, buy ammunition, buy a cartridge loader, and whatever it is, if Taitu and Menelik want it, Ilg is the guy that they're going to send off to do it. He even picks up personal items. I mean, in the correspondence between Ilg and Taitu and Menelik, you see Taitu saying, well, don't forget to pick up a pair of shoes for me. She's fond of European footwear. You know, she sends along her foot size. Whatever it is, Ilg's the guy who does it. He's also, of course, the person who can interpret European intent and European actions to the imperial couple. And
just as important. He can shape the image of Ethiopia within Europe, and he does this very artfully. He, for example, is the person who suggests that Ethiopia should have its own postage stamps and its own coinage. And we may think, oh, well, these are trivial matters, but these are some of the more fundamental, tangible emblems of independent sovereignty. And as such, I think Ilg, and through him, the imperial couple, understand just how important these symbolic markers are. He also gives interviews with the European press, where he puts forward the Ethiopian point of view, and he knows just which buttons to push. He's ably supported by a journalist named Kazimir Mondan Videle, who goes on to become a kind of Abyssinian or Amharic language and literature expert. But in his early years, Kazimir is sending dispatches to the European press, writing in laudable terms about the Ethiopian court, its leading figures, and emphasizing the things I think that Europeans would identify with. I mean, Ethiopia is an overwhelmingly Christian country. Certainly the court of Menelik is. They, in the images that they release, they emphasize Menelik's Christian heritage. They always show him with the crucifix high at the neck. They talk about the court in Ethiopia in terms of a kind of a medieval European past, all of which help to create an investment on the part of Europeans in the fate of Ethiopia. So it's not so much clearly a European versus African struggle, but one in which Europeans can even in a sense identify with Ethiopia and see in some ways it's a real relationship. So a hearts and minds relationship is an important part of the soft power struggle that Alfred Ilg and other Europeans help Menelik to lead.
And all of this shapes the European reaction to the conflict between Italy and Ethiopia. How does that break out? What's the origin of the falling out of between Ethiopia or between Menelik and the Italians?
Well, in diplomatic terms, there's a treaty that's negotiated. It's actually in the works at the time, in the twilight of the reign of Emperor Johannes, when Johannes dies in a battle against the Mahdi in Sudan, Menelik claims the throne, and the Italians move in, and building on the relationship they've cultivated over the years, they negotiate a treaty at a place called Vucale, and this treaty becomes the foundation for relations between Italy and Ethiopia. It's also the origin of the conflict that would lead to the Battle of Adwa, in that there's one of the articles from the Italian point of view establishes a protectorate relationship over Ethiopia, Article 17. It becomes a point of detonation for the conflict because it's claimed that in the Amharic version, nothing like a protectorate is established. It simply says that Ethiopia may turn to the Italians to represent it abroad, not that it must, not that it's obliged to. In my reading, and this is one of the areas where I think I make an original contribution to the story, in my reading, I think it's pretty clear that everybody understands that, yes, there is a protectorate. And the way I make this case is I follow the Ethiopian delegation to Italy, where they go and they sign the treaty. And there at the court of the Italian king, there's all this language of protectorate. The Ethiopian delegation seeks the protection of Italy, and the king confers protection on Ethiopia. This is all fairly clear. My interpretation is what the Ethiopians are doing with the Treaty of Vucale is buying time, that they are using the language of protectorate and in order to prepare for the conflict that they know is coming. In effect, they buy themselves some critical months in which they can acquire further arms, build an army, and launch the campaign that would ultimately lead to the eviction of the Italians.
As I said earlier, it's not just about the battle, but this kind of magnificent procession from the court in southern Ethiopia to the north, where the Italians are occupying Ethiopian territory, and that the success of that procession is cr- critical for the outcome of the battle and for Menelik's success.
That's right. The one of the features of Ethiopian armies is they can move very, very fast, far out exceeding the speed with which European armies of the day could move. But in the long campaign leading up to Adwa, from Addis Ababa in the south to Adwa in the north, it's hundreds of miles. It's this lengthy campaign which proceeds at a stately pace. Empress Taitu and Emperor Menelik are part of this campaign. They move barely 5 miles a day when something like 25, 30 or more would be certainly within the power of an Ethiopian army. But it's more of a stately procession. In part, it's clear they're testing the loyalty of the population and they're testing their authority. So for them, it's very important to show their largesse, to gather in contingents of troops from other regional leaders, building an army of over 100,000, building loyalties, testing relationships. So when the decisive encounter occurs farther north, they are fully in command of their forces, fully in command of a massive army, and confident that those relationships and those loyalties won't break apart on the eve of battle or even worse in the midst of battle.
Yeah, so it's not just about outnumbering the Italians at the point of the battle, but it is this campaign that you compare to, you know, the greatest European campaigns that we're all familiar with, even Napoleonic ones, in terms of the distances traveled, and the way that Menelik clearly outmaneuvers the Italians and packs them into a place where they essentially have to attack.
Yes, one of the points I make is that this is one of the 19th century's greatest campaigns. If you look at, you know, Gettysburg, or you look at Sherman's March to the Sea, I mean, these are great campaigns over significant different distances and over great periods of time and great logistical challenges for an army. But, the Menelik campaign is 500 miles. It's many months, from September to the 1st of March. I mean, this is keeping an army in the field that long is an astonishing feat, and it needs to be recognized as a major accomplishment. Napoleon's campaign from Vilnius to Moscow comes close. It's about 490 miles, number of months. Of course, it ends in defeat. And Menelik's campaign is a marvel simply as a logistical challenge. As a strategic enterprise, it's impressive too, because what Menelik is able to do by building an army so large that the Italians don't dare confront it in the open field is that they really limit the strategic options, the options available to the Italians. By the end of the campaign, the Italians are, at least Oreste Barattieri, the commander in chief of Italian forces, he knows that he can't fight this army in the field. He hopes to lure them into attacking him in a fortified position. And of course, Menelik doesn't take the bait. Instead, Menelik realizes that he can win this campaign simply by marching past the Italians into Eritrea, creating disorder in the lines of communication and effects, establishing authority over the entire Italian claimed territories. It is, in effect, the Battle of Adwa is a battle that doesn't need to be fought. There's a kind of checkmate situation that exists simply because there's no way that a reasonable commander would give battle to an army of this size.
And yet,
Barattieri
does.
Well, that's right. So part of the story I tell is exactly how this conflict happens. And Barattieri knows he's defeated, that his best choice in the situation is not to fight Menelik's army, but to retreat into Eritrea, defend his lines of communication. With every step into Eritrea, he's moving closer to his lines of communication and stretching Menelik even further. He needs to hold on to his army. He needs to hold on to what he can of Eritrea. Instead, his brigadier generals, who resent him, they're all from high-born Italian families, and some of them are just recently arrived in in Ethiopia. They want a decisive encounter. They believe the worst of the Ethiopian army. They believe all the rumors, all the disinformation that Menelik's agents were sending out about how his army is riven by factions, demoralized, starved, and anxious to go home. And the brigadier generals believe that, and they push against Baratieri. They want a decisive encounter. They finally badger Baratieri to the point that he agrees to an aggressive advance, not an attack, but an aggressive advance to passes near the town of Adwa, thinking that perhaps they could force Menelik into attacking them there in a highly disadvantageous position. And if Menelik did so, they would have a chance of winning. Instead, the brigadier generals ignore Baratieri's explicit instructions, and the disaster that unfolds is the disaster of the morning of the 1st of March, where they overshoot their destinations, and in effect, I think rather conclusively, quite deliberately, engage Menelik's forces in the open field with a disaster that follows.
And there's like a kind of conspiracy among the brigadiers to not just to exceed their mandate, but then almost, I mean, maybe I'm overstating your case, but to leave that gap in between the two brigades that advance out to mm-hmm. force Baratieri to bring the entire Italian force forward into the battle with disastrous consequences.
Yeah, the evidence that we have, I mean, the evidence is partial because two of the brigadier generals die at Adwa, and so we don't have their accounts. But we do have other accounts from two brigadiers who did survive, and we have the commentary that comes from discussions they have with other soldiers and other eyewitnesses after the fact. And the image that emerges is that of a kind of collusion on the part of the brigadier generals to force Baratieri forward into a direct attack on Ethiopian forces. The best evidence of this is that the brigades that are the left and right wing of the army leave a brigade-sized gap right in the center, which serves as an invitation to Baratieri to move his forces up, send a brigade that will occupy that central position and complete the front against the Ethiopian forces. We also have communications from one of the brigadier generals, Albertone, back to Baratieri, in effect ordering him to bring the Aramondi brigade up and fill that central space. I think the evidence is pretty powerful that this is an act of insubordination, really, that leads to disaster at Adwa.
And the carnage that ensues is really remarkable. I would say unspeakable, but you write about it in great detail.
Yes, right. And this obviously has to be laid at the doorstep of the brigadier generals who put their men in harm's way. But Ethiopian practice in the 19th century is to take trophies from the victims, and in fact, this is not a professional army. Their compensation that the Ethiopian soldiers get is whatever they can remove from the bodies of the fallen. And so the bodies of the fallen are stripped and trophies are taken. And in the case of Ethiopian practice, this includes castration and taking the scrotum as a trophy. Menelik opposes this, and he had opposed it verbally, and he had told his army that this was not to happen. He actually says, "Don't bring me the testicles, bring me the man," because he knows that the Italian soldiers are worth more as prisoners. But there are mutilations that take place on the battlefield in the aftermath of the battle. And then what happens to the soldiers themselves is difficult, too. And this is, I think, really another very interesting dimension of the battle, in that for the first time, Europeans are at the mercy of Africans in substantial numbers. Over 1,000 Italians are taken prisoner, and Menelik realizes that they represent substantial leverage in peace negotiations, and he marches them back south, back to Addis Ababa. They're billeted on the population. All the hundreds remain in Addis Ababa under the care of Menelik and Taitu. Their story is interesting too, but it is the aftermath, I argue, is at least as interesting as the battle itself. And the whole final third of the book is devoted to the story of these various aftermaths, some of them horrific, some of them actually quite touching.
Yeah, that was. I wanted to make sure that we mentioned that the denouement of this of the battle involving these prisoners, the Italian prisoners, important for the reasons that you just mentioned. But also, I kind of appreciated the reminder also that there were Africans on both sides of the battle, the Ascari that formed a significant component of the Italian army.
That's right. The Italians early on in their expansion in East Africa. Realize that they can field a more cost-effective army, and in fact, a speedier army if they hire locals into their ranks. And so they create first four and eventually eight battalions of native troops known as Ascari. They are Eritrean, they are Sudanese, they are even Ethiopian. And they're put in uniform and trained and equipped, and they fight on behalf of Italy in Eritrea and in Ethiopia. By all accounts, they are quite effective soldiers. They are in local terms quite well paid. They enjoy a certain wealth and a certain prestige in the community. Their fate after the battle is horrific too, because they are regarded not as prisoners by the Ethiopians, but as traitors. And for that, they are punished by they lose their right hand and their left foot so that they won't fight again. This penalty would be imposed was a matter of debate at court in the aftermath of the battle. Here too, there's the maximalist faction, and Taitu is part of it, and a more moderate faction, which is anchored by Menelik. But ultimately, it's the maximalists who win out, in part because in the aftermath of the battle, the Ethiopians had lost many, many lives, and there is, as one might well imagine, a desire for punishment. And so I describe these scenes where Ascari are brought forward one by one. They have to submit to punishment, and it becomes obviously a black mark on the Italians who bring these soldiers into these circumstances, and it becomes, in that sense, a public relations problem for Italy. It also, I argue, is something that has to be kept in mind when we think about the later rupture in relations between Eritrea and Ethiopia. In a sense, there is a river of blood that divides these two.
Right. Well, I think we've certainly hit the highlights of this great book. I mean, it really makes clear the way that Menelik's talents as a campaigner, and then as a statesman involving the repatriation of these prisoners and the preservation of Ethiopian sovereignty. It was really terrific, and I thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed it very much.
I always like to conclude the interview by asking you for a book that I might read in the future and feature on the podcast. Do you have any suggestions along those lines?
I do. I would recommend Philip Dwyer's Napoleon, The Path to Power, a Yale book that I think is a great read and a nice new synthesis. Not exactly military history, but a good history that probably would be of interest to people who are looking at 20th century issues is Katharina Clark's Moscow, the Fourth Rome, which is published last year gives us, I think, a really different take on a major power of the 20th century, obviously the Soviet Union.
Well, thanks for those suggestions. I've noted them down. And thanks again for joining me today.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to an interview with Raymond Jonas, the author of The Battle of Padua, African Victory in the Age of Empire, new in 2011 from Harvard University Press. This is New Books in Military History. Hope you'll join us again.